It's a great pleasure to mark what has been an enormous achievement. An enormous achievement for Australian science.
The new resurrected science minister Kim Carr on Tuesday launching the Murchison Telescope. The start of things to come with the Square Kilometre Array in Western Australia. Hello, I'm Robin Williams with The Science Show, where we sniff T-shirts, take ancient DNA from teeth, and even go to hell in the end. Back to Kim Carr and the Murchison.
A little over 3 years ago, I was fortunate enough to visit the West Murchison site just as the planning for this project had commenced. And it shows to me what a great difference 3 years does make. I have been absent from the scientific portfolio for a little while. Some unhappy events in recent times have kept me away. But I can say to you that I'm delighted, absolutely delighted, to be able to be back amongst you and to continue the work that we commenced together. And it was a project like this that really inspired me. It demonstrated the ambition of Australian science, the capacity of this country to actually lead the world, to be able to provide the wherewithal, not just to work within the scientific community at a level which I think internationally we are recognised to have a great deal to contribute, but also to lead this country. Because my argument has always been that if we are to build a modern Australia, if we are to build a new country, then we've got to look to you to help us do that. Because it's science and research that should be at the cutting edge of the great transformation that this country so desperately needs. And surely a project like this demonstrates that point.
Science Minister Kim Carr and Stephen Tingay, Professor of Radio Astronomy at Curtin University in Perth, describes the region where the new telescope is laid.
The Murchison region is, well, in a word, empty, but that's the reason we're out there. It's very sparsely populated. It's very flat, quite arid. So where there is vegetation, it's relatively low, scrubby type of vegetation. It's one of those places where you go out at night time, and if it's dark and there's no moon, you simply feel immersed in the universe, horizon to horizon. Dark skies and Milky Way stars all overhead. It's quite an amazing, pristine, quiet place to be.
Sounds wonderful. The instrument itself, I had visions of something like the dish, but it looks quite different. It looks as if there are a whole number of squarish things with elbows stretching out on the ground.
Yeah, it's quite a strange thing to look at, and it's very non-typical of radio telescopes. But this is the future of radio astronomy instrumentation. So telescopes like the dish use a curved surface to bring radio waves to a focus. Parkes is 64 metres across. It's a massive construction of concrete and steel and very expensive to build for the amount of collecting area that you get. What we have are very, very simple low-frequency antennas with no moving parts. A lot like an FM antenna that you might buy at the electronics shop. We build a lot of them and we scatter them out all over the ground. In the case of the MWA, over an area 3 kilometres in diameter. So we have several thousand individual antennas clumped into groups of 16, and we have 128 groups of 16. Now, instead of physically moving the antennas to look at different parts of the sky, we can look in different directions simply by adjusting the electronics on the back of the antenna. So it's a fully electronically steerable instrument. We combine all the signals from all the antennas, and all of the smarts are in the back end in the computing and the signal processing. Yeah, people find it odd to look at, and it can be difficult to explain because it looks sort of so different to what people usually think of.
And when you're steering it, are you out there in the wilderness or are you some remote place doing it electronically?
Yeah, well, this is the great advantage of having a telescope with no moving parts and simply depends on computing behind the scenes. So when we run the instrument, we're either running it from our offices in Perth over the internet, or our colleagues are running it from their offices in the US. So it doesn't require anyone to be on site. In fact, that's a lot better because it means we're not out there generating radio interference with our cars and electronics and everything else running around in the field. That massively slashes the operational cost of running such an instrument as well.
And meanwhile, of course, you're getting a vast amount of information pouring through. I mean, the SKA is going to be gigantic, but already this is a huge amount of information you must crunch.
Oh, absolutely. One of the characteristics of these types of simple antennas is that they see the entire sky, which means that you can collect data across huge sweeps of the sky and therefore the universe in one go. Produces huge amounts of data. So over the first 1,000 hours of observing, we will collect something like 3 petabytes worth of data. Those data are transmitted from the Murchison on a dedicated optical fibre link down to a brand new supercomputing centre in Perth, where all the data are stored and teams from around the world access those data and produce the images of the sky and therefore extract the information. So it's really a software-defined telescope, creates massive amounts of data and requires really substantial supercomputing facilities to crunch through it all.
And what's the first job?
We've just undertaken a round of accepting proposals from the international community. We've selected 9 proposals to support in the first 6 months of observing. And those projects range from the first search for the birth of the very first stars and galaxies within the first 1 billion years of the universe, all the way through to monitoring our sun and tracking solar flares and how they interact with the Earth's upper atmosphere, as well as surveying our galaxy, the Milky Way, and galaxies millions to billions of light years away, and also looking for transient objects in the universe, things that go bump in the night or very energetic explosions from within our galaxy and other galaxies. So a really wide raft of different types of science, and that's another characteristic of the telescope. We can pursue lots of different things, and in fact we can pursue multiple science programs simultaneously. So one observation will oftentimes support a number of different science cases.
Yes, very powerful. Now, how is that going to connect with the Square Kilometre Array, which is going to be open and off and running in about 4 years' time, 5 years' time?
Yeah, the MWA is one of 3 official precursor instruments for the much larger multi-billion square kilometre array. A precursor means that we're using the MWA as a science and technology demonstrator for the SKA. The SKA is at the moment in what's called the pre-construction phase, which means that over the next 3 or 4 years, we'll come up with the final tender-ready specifications to start building the SKA. In order to do that, we need to prove and verify the technology that goes into the SKA, but we also need to take the first steps in the key science areas, and those steps will inform the definition of the science case for the SKA, which then folds into the design of the instrument itself.
And the instrument is going to be, the SKA is going to be in South Africa, and it's also going to be in Western Australia. Is it close to Murchison where you are?
It's right there. So the MWA is built on exactly the site where the Australian component of the SKA will be built.
Exciting for you, isn't it?
It's the product of years of work by a massive team of people, 13 institutions in 4 countries, and a complicated project that's had its highs and lows, and a lot of us have left a fair bit of blood on the floor over this project over the years. So it just defies words, really, just how satisfying it is to be embarking upon finally this incredible science with this amazing instrument.
Yes, you've got there, and it's the new frontier of astronomy, isn't it?
It's just so exciting. It's opening up a really unique window on the last really unexplored epoch in the history of our universe. That first 1 billion years is only really accessible to low-frequency radio telescopes of this type. So our technology is at the point where we can really start to explore that unknown period, and that's just so incredibly exciting.
Stephen Tingay is Professor of Radio Astronomy at Curtin University on the Murchison Telescope and what it means for the giant to come, the Square Kilometre Array. And a final word from Minister Kim Carr.
The SKA, of course, is the next great achievement. And, in fact, we talk of this project being a pathfinder. The SKA, to me, is also a great pathfinder. a pathfinder to that new society. This project is so big that it can't just be left in the hands of radio astronomers. It's so important to the country that you've got a right to look to us to help you as government, but I say to you, we've got a right to look to you to help us answer the big questions for the 21st century. And it's projects like this that allow us to do it. So it's not just the scientific discoveries that you're making, but it's also the capacity to transform the way we do business. But it's money so incredibly well spent. Now, I take the view that this is a project that confirms the value of building that great social compact between our researchers and our community. And I look forward to watching this project unfold and us delivering on both sides of that compact. Thank you very much.
Minister Kim Carr of the Murchison Launch. And so, from the sublime...
We've made up the invitations. The packages have all been sent.
What have you got here, Stream? T-shirt. An elusive ticket to Catalyst Pheromone Party.
Everyone I've talked to about it has been, you're going to a party to smell someone's shirt?
Yes, Catalyst is about to throw a pheromone party on the 25th of this month, sniffing T-shirts. But the science originally comes from the renowned Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology. Getting the odours right actually helped you and your ancestors survive. Get the smells wrong and you died. Here's Dr. Jonica Newby of Catalyst.
So, we have on the line from Germany, Professor Manfred Milinski. Welcome.
How do you do?
It turns out we can hold you personally responsible for starting this whole T-shirt sniffing craze.
Yeah, that's true.
But what on earth made you even think of trying it?
The problem is that we still cannot explain why most plants and animals, including humans, reproduce sexually. This is so inefficient, you wouldn't believe it. So asexual reproduction would be more than twice as efficient, but still we do it. And we learned from Darwin that everything which has evolved and is here is the best answer to selection pressure. So why is sexual reproduction so good? The point is that for each reproduction, you throw away half of your genes and then invest a lot of time and energy, which you call mate choice and display behavior, to find somebody else to fill up from him what you've thrown away. This is ridiculous, but it must make sense, and it makes sense only if the environment changes all the time. So what you collected last time or your parents collected for you is no longer the best solution. So this requires that there are genes with which we respond to this dramatic environmental change that we don't know about. And these genes should differ among individuals so that you don't get back what you've thrown away. You have to choose your partner in a way that he offers the optimal complement genetically what you have retained yourself. And now comes your question, why did we do the T-shirt experiment? Now, in mice that had been found out before, just by accident, that mice can smell out which immunogene versions potential partners carry. And because this part of the immune system is exactly the same in all vertebrates, we thought at the time in Switzerland we could repeat the mouse experiment with humans and then had males and females immune typed so that we exactly knew which versions they carried, and then arranged a test so that each woman was presented with 6 T-shirts worn by 6 different men, and 3 were as similar as possible to the choosing woman and 3 were as different as possible. And she had to decide alone in a room, not influenced by anybody, which smelled good or which smelled nasty. And she found, and all these women found, that the ones worn by men, which are different immunogene versions from the ones she carried, smelled wonderful, and the similar one smelled bad. And so this means that we prefer as partners people who offer other immunogen versions that we carry ourselves. And this is a very good solution because this provides our offspring with a broad range of immunogens.
It was pretty brave, Manfred, to think, wasn't it, that just because mice can smell immune systems, that humans also use smell to detect genes. Were you a little surprised at how well it worked?
To be honest, not at all, because we knew already that this part of the immune system is highly conserved from the sharks onwards and all vertebrates. And you wouldn't believe it, we showed here the same thing with fish. And fish, as I said, have the same kind of immune system. They also smell out partners according to the immune genes they offer. And with fish, we could do this experiment because they have their lifetime reproductive success in only one season, in one summer. And you wouldn't believe it, but there was a dramatic difference between offspring produced with preferred partners compared to offspring with unpreferred partners. When we put them out in the lake and exposed them to all infectious diseases in the lake, the preferred ones were very healthy, had a lot of children themselves, and the other ones suffered from all kinds of infectious diseases. And we assume that the same would happen in humans. So be careful when you smell out your partner.
Well, yes. I mean, I guess from what your fish experiment shows is that if we do produce offspring with a man who smells really bad, chances are our offspring will suffer.
But I cannot prove it. We cannot do such an experiment, of course, with humans. But it has been repeated, our fish experiments, now several times with other vertebrate species, and the same result shows up again and again.
Well, look, when you did that T-shirt sniffing test, I mean, first of all, were you surprised by how big the reaction was to your results?
Yeah, a bit. This time, when we published the composition of the natural perfume with which we signal our immune genes, the response of the media was much stronger than in former times to the T-shirt experiment.
It sounds like a trivial thing, sniffing T-shirts, but it's actually very profound, this discovery.
Yeah, you would not just by accident do this experiment. You must have a reason.
The fact that humans do it, we tend to dismiss the sense of smell. It seems almost too extraordinary to be true that we can actually smell immunity genes.
Yeah, this is a mistake that people usually do, that our sense of smell is not very strong. We think we do most decisions on visual information, which might be true, but our sense of smell is much, much better than we think. Human beings can distinguish more than 10,000 different kinds of smell. This is quite a lot. So it's not surprising that we are able to do the same thing as mice can do and fish can do and birds can do.
So let me understand this. We tend to think of body odor as something we should get rid of. We tend to think it's dirty. But is it actually primarily our immunity genes?
Now, if you think of bad body odor, you think of sweat, which has not been washed since days. But this is not the kind of smell that tells about immune genes. This is quite unconscious. So if somebody has taken a shower in the evening and then the next day there will be this natural perfume produced, and I think it axilla odor, it comes from underneath your armpits, but it's not stinky or smelling bad. If you have searched for your own perfume, which you like to wear on yourself, I guess you spent a long time to find it. And this is true for almost everybody. We search for a long time until we find a perfume that we like on our body, ourselves. But we like many different ones on other people. And this is what we tested after the T-shirt experiment in Bern. We tested the same volunteers for their choice and preference of perfume to be used on themselves, and found strong correlations with the kind of immune gene versions they carried.
What do you mean?
Well, the point is, we pay a lot of attention to how we smell, and we use perfumes since at least 5,000 years in all cultures. And my idea was that your choice of perfume has something to do with your immune gene order that you emit. Maybe you try to amplify your own signal by using and selecting the right perfume. And this suggested to me, at least, that your immune genes not only tell you or force you to select a partner that smells the way that he offers the best complement and immune genes for your immune genes to produce resistant children, it also tells me that these immune genes force you to select a perfume on yourself that does not destroy this message, and that it even amplifies your own message.
Professor Manfred Milinski is head of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology in Germany, and the Pheromone Party, hosted by Dr. Jonica Newby, is on Catalyst on Thursday evening at 8, ABC One. That's on July the 25th, more next week. And if you imagine that built-up resistance to disease is kind of trivial, just think. Some of the plagues just a few centuries ago wiped out nearly half the people in Europe. Here's Paul Olding in London on how tracking ancient DNA can help us even now.
Ever since the chemical structure of DNA was decoded in the 1950s, the science surrounding deoxyribose nucleic acid has seen some incredible advances. From understanding the origins and evolution of DNA, to its role in hereditary diseases, to using it CSI style at crime scenes. But now a team of scientists in Germany have created a brand new field of study. They've been developing new techniques in DNA analysis to unravel the cause of ancient pandemics and investigate the evolution of killer diseases. Johannes Krauser is Professor of Paleogenetics at the University of Tübingen near Stuttgart in Germany. His previous work was on ancient human species.
A couple of years ago, we tried to reconstruct the whole genome of an extinct archaic human called the Neanderthal, which is really famous ancient hominin, and we were actually able to reconstruct quite a big part of that Neanderthal genome over a period of about 4 years.
During their research, the team discovered something astonishing.
During the Neanderthal genome project, we were actually fortunate enough to find evidence of a new hominin that wasn't known before. We got a little bone piece from Siberia that we extracted the DNA from. We looked at the DNA. We found out that it was neither DNA of a Neanderthal nor DNA of a modern human, but it was something completely new, something unknown that we called Denisovan based on the place where it was discovered, the Denisova cave in the Altai Mountains.
After his success with ancient humans, Johannes saw a new application for using ancient DNA, the possibility of decoding ancient disease.
Diseases are quite exciting, of course, in the way that they're a really dangerous thing. They have, in the past, killed millions of people. Still today, millions of people die every year of infectious disease. However, what we know very little about is about the evolution of the pathogens that cause those infectious diseases. But what we can provide with ancient DNA is molecular fossils. We can go back into historical populations, reconstruct the pathogen that was present 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, and then we can study the evolution of the pathogen by comparing the ancient pathogen genome, for example, to the modern pathogen and see how it has changed over time. And that is really exciting because that makes us to understand how pathogens actually evolved over time.
In 2011, Johannes and his team made their first major breakthrough. They were called in to find out what disease may have been responsible for causing the infamous Black Death.
So the Black Death was certainly the biggest pandemic in history that we know of. And for a long time, it wasn't really clear what has caused this pandemic. What pathogen was responsible for this millions of death? And there was a lot of hypotheses, but it was really difficult to prove what was the causative agent.
The Black Death lasted for 5 years and killed up to 50 million people. That's around 50% of the entire population of Western Europe. Back in 1986, archaeologists from the Museum of London excavated over 600 bodies from a huge Black Death mass grave in London's East Smithfield. Historical accounts tell us that victims were buried here sometime during 1348, right when the disease was raging across Europe. Johannes and his team were given access to the skeletons.
So we extracted DNA from people that have died during this time period, the Black Death, actually from London. And we were specifically looking for one pathogen, which was the prime candidate that a lot of people thought was responsible. That's Yersinia pestis that caused bubonic plague.
Symptoms of bubonic plague include swollen glands, fever, vomiting blood, and even gangrene of the extremities, followed by rapid death. All of these symptoms match those recorded in historical accounts of the people that died during the Black Death. But no one could be certain if bubonic plague was the disease responsible. Earlier attempts to confirm the culprit were met with some controversy.
So then scientists have tried from fossil remains to extract Yersinia pestis DNA from medieval skeletons. And indeed, at the end of the 90s, people were able to find Yersinia pestis DNA, the cause of age of bubonic plague, in medieval skeletons. However, there was controversy about that findings because it wasn't really clear if this could be contamination, because in the same lab, people also worked with modern Yersinia pestis bacteria, or if this is indeed ancient DNA. Because other people tried to replicate those results, and they could not replicate that. So there was a big controversy. So over 15 years, scientists were discussing whether those early results were true or whether they might be false due to contamination. And only when we started with new technologies to not only look if the DNA is present, but also to show that this DNA is indeed ancient DNA, that this is old DNA, this is medieval DNA, by actually looking at DNA damage patterns, we could show with our work that that DNA is indeed ancient, that is present in this medieval skeleton, so it was indeed Yersinia pestis that was present during that time, so it was likely a bubonic plague pandemic that has basically caused the plague death.
This was the first time that the cause of an ancient killer disease had been identified through the DNA of the pathogen responsible. This huge breakthrough, proving the Black Death was caused by the bubonic plague bacterium Yersinia pestis, was only possible due to major advances in DNA science.
So there's two major changes that happened in genetics over the last couple of years. Especially in the field of ancient DNA, the big invention was next generation sequencing, how they call it. So which is the technology that allows us to reconstruct entire genomes in a very rapid way, because we can now sequence millions and even billions of DNA molecules in a very short time, in just a few days, which is a major breakthrough that has changed the entire field of genetics, also ancient DNA. So we can really look a lot of data. The other technology that came available in the last couple of years is fishing technologies, because what we get out of a fossil bone is a very complex mixture of DNA. Only a few molecules are the ones that we're interested in, but there's a lot of background DNA, plants, fungi, microorganisms, everything that lives in the soil, that lives in a bone, that we basically get from the fossil. And maybe just a tiny proportion, a thousandth of that, is the pathogen that we're interested in. So we somehow have to get those molecules out of that complex mixture.
What Yohannes calls his fishing technique actually goes by the name of DNA hybridization capture. The process begins first by extracting teeth from the ancient skeletons. It's possible to use bones, but they can degrade terribly in a grave. Teeth, on the other hand, provide ideal storage vessels for DNA because of the presence of the hard enamel coat sealing the spongy pulp within. But being buried in the ground for hundreds of years, any remnants of DNA from bacterial or viral pathogens are mixed up with a whole cocktail of other organic molecules. Yohannes' colleague, Kirsten Boss, explains how they start to isolate the DNA.
The first step in any analysis of ancient DNA requires what's called the DNA extraction. And that's where you separate your DNA from all the other molecules that are present within the bone. So primarily proteins, for example, or any other molecules that have accumulated from its having been in the soil for hundreds and hundreds of years. And once you have your isolated DNA, the next step becomes a little bit challenging because you have to try to identify individual fragments that are present within this extract. So you're going to have DNA in there from all sources that that bone or tooth has come into contact with over the years. So the question is, how do we access this pathogen DNA from this complex background of other DNA molecules?
This is where their new fishing technique comes in.
So if you think about your DNA extract is your pond, and somewhere in that pond there's a few fish that you want to selectively remove. What we do is we design baits, which are short stretches of DNA that will match specific molecules of interest. And we can then expose our baits to our DNA extract, and through a process called DNA hybridization, we can hope that our DNA of interest will bind to our baits, and then we can selectively pull those out from that very complex background of DNA of all those different sources.
The baits are synthetic strands of DNA. They can be specially designed to have unique genetic codes of all manner of killer pathogens, from smallpox to typhus, measles to bubonic plague.
And how does a bait work? Is it something special about the way DNA is constructed?
It's something special about the way DNA binds. So a bait is a piece of what's called single-stranded DNA. DNA normally exists in double strands, so it's normally two complementary strands that actually bind to each other. And when you have a bait that's one piece of single-stranded DNA, if you can render the DNA you've extracted from the tooth to be single-stranded, then the DNA from your tooth that matches the bait can then bind. And our hope is that some of the sequences that we have successfully fished out of our extracts are those of these ancient pathogens.
The DNA that attaches to the baits is then sequenced, and the resulting genetic codes compared with a huge database of genetic sequences of known pathogens. This is where the hard graft really begins.
Yes, so the major challenge is because of this next generation sequencing that gives us millions of DNA sequences, we cannot look at DNA anymore just by our eyes. When I started to work in the lab, we still got just a few DNA fragments that I could actually look at with my eyes, that I could compare, that I could align, I could puzzle together longer stretches of DNA. Today, because we have whole genomes that are billions and billions of base pairs long, we cannot do that by eyes, by our hand anymore. We need really powerful computers to put together these genomes again. And one good example is when I started to work in the lab, we were 12 people working in the lab and 2 people working on the computer. The same working group now has 15 people working on the computer and 2 people working in the lab. Because most of the work today is really computational work, so the field has also changed from molecular biologists. Most people are now bioinformaticians. They're actually computer people now that do genetics.
Following on from their success with the Black Death, Johannes and his team have taken on more cases as part of their ancient DNA-based CSI whodunits. Most recently, they were called in to help a team of French and Italian archaeologists who had unearthed a new tomb within one of Rome's famous catacombs. It was found to contain over 2,000 bodies, dating from the 1st to 3rd century AD, the height of the Roman Empire.
From historical work, we know that during that time in Rome, there was this major pandemic going on that's called the Antonine Plague, which was probably killing millions of people and was all over the Roman Empire during that time. So there's a high chance that this mass burial that we have here in Rome was a mass burial from that time, because why else would they try to bury so many people in such a short time period and bring them all together in this few rooms?
Unlike their work on the Black Death, where they already had a single prime suspect, for the bodies found in the catacomb in Rome, there are no accounts as to what might have killed these people.
So therefore, we are really kind of fishing into the dark right now. What is the pathogen that we should look at? And this is also why we decided to do a more general approach, not just looking for one candidate pathogen, but actually looking for multiple pathogens in parallel to see which one might be present in that population.
And after 3 months, how's your work going?
They actually found really good DNA preservation. So at least we have a lot of DNA. Unfortunately, right now, we do not know what that DNA is because we're just in the process to actually looking at the DNA itself. So we have started to enrich, fish out the pathogen DNA. So we have looked for hundreds of pathogens in parallel, actually, because we don't know what is the pathogen to look for. And we have already produced a lot of DNA sequences. But since it's millions of DNA sequences, we're just in the process now of sorting those. And there's a lot of bioinformatic work, computational work now looking at that. But basically the molecular biology, the lab work is finished now. Now we're in the process of just looking at the data.
Johannes and his team certainly have their work cut out for them. But this is an area in DNA science which is not only helping to solve millennia-old cold cases, but also give valuable insight into the emergence and evolution of diseases themselves, diseases that still strike our world today.
Paul Olding in London. He was a producer on Brian Cox's first Wonder series, and Wonders of Life still runs on ABC One. That's after Catalyst on Thursdays, which in early August features those teeth Paul Olding's just been talking about. This is The Science Show on RN, where we now leap to Adelaide, where Dr. Alan Cooper is one of those examining ancient teeth for signs of DNA.
From where do you get this plaque? Which sort of creatures?
Principally, we're working on humans, but we've also measured it on chimpanzees, Neanderthals. You can find it on many things. For example, domestic dogs have a lot of it because of the carbohydrate these days, the kibble and stuff like that, which is a big problem for them.
And it's still there, even in fossils?
Yes, it's actually quite tightly bound to the tooth. This is what you see in the television adverts, where they tell you only a dentist can remove this stuff, because that's true. It's calcified on, it's almost like scale on pipes, lime scale. And that's what the dentist does with that annoying sonic machine, is actually vibrating or shocking it off, because otherwise you've got to pull it off with a metal pick. It's quite tightly held on.
Now, what made you think of analysing what was in the plaque, DNA-wise?
It was actually a colleague of mine from the UK, from the University of Aberdeen, a guy called Keith Dobney, who's an archaeologist, who many years ago, 20 or so, figured out that this calcified plaque might contain bits of food. And therefore, if you looked at it under a microscope, you might be able to work out what people were eating. And so he set out to do this and measured quite a few specimens under increasingly powerful microscopes and found that while you could see a little bit of food, it was normally unidentifiable, what he could see was enormous numbers of what we call the exoskeletons of bacteria, the kind of outside surface which was preserved in calcite, effectively, just huge teeming ecosystems of them in the calculus. Of course, he didn't have any ability of DNA, but he recognized instantly, okay, that's primarily what you're looking at, huge amounts of bacteria calcified in place. And when I visited him, when I was at the University of Oxford, to talk about some archaeological projects, he asked, why doesn't someone try and extract DNA from this calculus? And 20 years later, we've finally managed to do it. We've been working ever since. One of the big problems we had was that, of course, bacteria are everywhere, on every surface, and even in the ancient DNA lab with the positive air pressure and the ultraviolet lights, and we bleach everything all the time, there are bacteria that live in exactly those environments. So we had to be really sure the DNA sequences of bacteria that we were getting really were from the ancient samples and not from, for example, the soil that they had been buried in, or the laboratory, or the consumables that we use, the liquids and the enzymes and everything else. And that actually was probably the most difficult bit. And so about 2005, I think, we finally cracked it.
Which people did you analyse first?
We were working on collections of the medieval period from York. Keith had been formerly in York and had a large collection of different medieval populations, so we used those as our controls. And we were very suspicious, as we had been all along, that what we were getting was DNA from the soil or DNA from the lab. We had a dental student from Sydney, Christina Adler, who was keen to try this, and she came back with the first results saying it looks like a modern mouth-ish. And that's when we knew we were on the right track, because soil doesn't look like a modern mouth. And we figured, okay, this is real. Finally, we're getting the real information.
And what could you tell about their diet that you can actually tell from all the writings and all sorts of other evidence more easily?
Well, we so far haven't actually seen too much DNA from the food itself, although we're pretty convinced that's there as well. Primarily what we're seeing is different types of bacteria and the different proportions of those bacteria within the samples and how that changes as the human diet changes. So largely we're using archaeological information about what the diet is from the bits of food that survive in the graves or what is known from the time. And then we relate the bacterial changes to that which the archaeologists have already discerned. What we hope to do in the future, as we're now doing experiments, we're using far more powerful systems that we think will give us the DNA from the food in the calculus itself, in this calcified plaque, and that will really cross-check. We won't have to rely on the archaeological information to know that individual's eating yams or, you know, Mars bars, whatever.
And now that would be a surprise.
That would. We're looking for funding for the work, so I'm hoping the Mars company is listening to this and is ready to support us with large amounts of money.
Any surprises so far? are?
Well, the Mesolithic, the hunter-gatherers. The Meso is where they're kind of giving up on hunter-gathering but haven't really adopted farming. Those guys had a lot of bacteria that we now find only in ruminants, sheep and cows, animals that are eating a lot of vegetation. And so the suggestion would be that our hunter-gatherer friends were eating a lot of vegetation, far more than we are now, and those bacteria have disappeared, apart from one or two populations in the world. And some of those would be the Amazon Indians, the ones that are still doing that traditional lifestyle, eating a lot of vegetation. So you can see instantly how our diet has changed and the bacteria have changed with them.
And so you'd expect with meat eaters for a different floral population.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people probably overestimate the amount of meat that many of these hunter-gatherer groups did in fact eat. They ate a fair bit, but they also did a lot of foraging for roots, tubers, various other types of food sources as well. Insects, I think, were a large component. And yes, we are just starting to do the kind of relationships between the type of diet people eat and the bacteria you get from that, because this is increasingly becoming a health concern for a lot of modern Western diseases.
Given what you've done, are you more thoughtful when you brush your own teeth these days?
Yes, I'm a lot more thorough about it, I must admit, but I'm not nearly as good at following the observations as I should be as a scientist, so I still do eat far too much. Bread and beer is very difficult to give up as well.
Alan Cooper is director of the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA, University of Adelaide, and you can see his team on Catalyst on August the 1st coming up. And this is The Science Show on RN, where we belatedly congratulate an Australian researcher working on stem cells. He won a prize awarded by the Vatican. Dr. Silvio Itescu is CEO of Mesoblast Limited in Melbourne.
Congratulations on the award. Was it a surprise for you?
Oh, it was a total surprise. Absolutely. Entirely unexpected. But in reality, I think it was recognition, the science that's coming out of Australia, really representing the innovation.
Why would the Vatican want to give an award?
Well, the Vatican held a special three-day meeting, predominantly featuring adult stem cell therapies to target various disease states. The Vatican has a view regarding adult stem cells versus embryonic stem cells, and in their view, adult stem cells is the area they choose to focus on.
And if you take these stem cells and put them where they're needed, say, to replace tissue, is there some concern about possible mutation and risk?
We haven't found any such risk. In fact, these cells respond to signals of damage from the tissue that they encounter. They release factors for a period of time. Then when those signals stop being emanated, they switch off. The advantage of these cells is that they can be used allogeneically, i.e. from one donor to an unrelated recipient, because they appear not to induce an immune response.
Where would you use them now, these days?
So we're looking at three major areas. We're looking in cardiovascular repair, we're looking at orthopedic diseases, and we're looking at diseases of inflammation and immune activation. We are about to embark on a phase 3 trial in congestive heart failure, where the cells are delivered by catheter into the left ventricle, the objective there being to induce repair and regeneration of blood vessels and heart muscle. We've completed a phase 2 program where they're being injected into intervertebral discs in patients in early stage disc degeneration in order to induce repair of the disc cartilage, and in later stage patients where they're implanted surgically in order to help induce bony fusion between two vertebrae. And in the third area, we're injecting them intravenously in patients with a number of major immune diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis and including diabetic kidney disease, where we hope to take advantage of the fact that these cells can home to the damaged tissues and result in a dampening down of the general inflammatory response that is associated with those diseases.
What was your opinion of the news from Oregon about the therapeutic stem cells that are derived, in fact, by definition, from the oocytes, the eggs of a woman, into which you've got a skin cell placed, which then will give you a different line of stem cells?
Look, I think it's a tremendous breakthrough. It's the area that people have been trying to develop for quite a few years. But in essence, I think what it does is provide scientists with an alternative source of embryonic-like stem cells. These cells, first of all, are pluripotent. Their ability to differentiate into multiple lineages.
Put them anywhere, they can turn into anything.
Yes, and by definition, they have a significant risk of turning into cancers, teratomas. And until we're absolutely clear about how to direct them into the particular lineage that we want them to go into, there remains that risk of their ability to have a single cell that can be cancer-producing. And I think that it will take scientists a significant amount of time to control and to understand the pathways by which these cells go before they're ready for clinical use.
Yeah.
So it comes back to the question you asked me earlier, which is the reason that our company is focusing on adult stem cells, which don't have those kind of inherent risks and will get us into, I hope, outcomes after phase three trials that over the next couple of years allow us to have cell therapy products in the market. I do believe, however, that over the next decade or so, there will be a series of cell-based products that are complementary and that are additive and synergistic. And so whilst we're initially developing adult stem cell-based products, I think that cloned products will be the next generation of cells once we understand how to best control them.
One thing that you can explain to me that I don't quite understand, if you've got an egg, a woman's egg, it can be my skin cell put into that egg so that I've got my nuclear genetics. People have been talking about using that line in case I've got a mitochondrial problem, that is the power packs of the body. Now, those power packs will have the woman's DNA, presumably. Won't there be a conflict?
No, so it's an interesting question. We have two sets of genes within our cells. One set of genes, of course, is in the nucleus, which controls most of the proteins in our bodies. Another set of genes are those genes related to the mitochondria, and they sit outside of the nucleus in the cytoplasm. So when we use a donor egg for the process of nuclear transfer, the nucleus is removed, and a nucleus from a skin cell, et cetera, or another cell is put in, which is ultimately the recipient's DNA. However, the mitochondrial genes remain intact, and they get passed along into the daughter cells. And those mitochondrial genes, as you state, come from the donor. So in this new technology, which will give rise to embryonic stem cells, the embryonic stem cell will have genes in the nucleus of the recipient and will have genes in the cytoplasm, in the mitochondrial DNA of the donor. Now, mitochondrial diseases, and of course we don't understand them fully, but they often have neurologic and muscular components. And obviously there's an interplay between the genes in the nucleus and the genes in the mitochondrial DNA. There's an opportunity generating these kind of embryonic stem cells to be able to address these kind of diseases because you potentially are generating healthy mitochondrial DNA for those patients who would need them. The reason why such cells would not be rejected is because the rejection genes resides in the nucleus. And so a daughter cell that has the donor's mitochondrial DNA will not be encoding genes of the donor because MHC genes will be entirely of the recipient of the host.
And I see, that makes sense, right. And presumably you can't just squirt mitochondria into people with mitochondrial disease. You've got to put them into some sort of cell so that they will survive.
Well, that's actually a very interesting concept in itself. And in fact, there are some very intriguing scientific papers coming back to the mesenchymal lineage stem cells that we're developing at Mesoblast that suggest that these kind of cells that we work with are able to transfer healthy mitochondria across small pores from themselves to target cells where the mitochondria might be exhausted or might be defective, such as heart muscle cells, such as endothelial cells, such as pulmonary cells. And in fact, that's a whole area of interesting focus around mechanism of action where we think our adult stem cells may have special characteristics.
Tell me, have you actually received your award and been to the Vatican? And
yeah, I was at the Vatican a couple of weeks ago, and I received their kind award, and look, it was terrific.
Interesting, isn't it, that there is so much science going on actually there in the Vatican, and has been for years.
Well, I think the objective of this meeting and others like it are intended by the Vatican to demonstrate that they would like to be aligned with where science is going. They were at great pains to describe to me about the National Academy of Sciences of the Vatican, the founder of which was Galileo, and apparently there are over 20 Nobel Prize winners. And they debate a variety of issues that are of topical interest globally, including stem cells, including global warming, etc. And I think this meeting represents an extension of that focus.
And it's worth remembering that Pope Francis is himself a science graduate and keen to promote scientific discourse. Dr. Silvio Itescu is winner of the inaugural Pontifical Award for Innovation and received it at a conference devoted to stem cell research held at the Vatican, where you would normally expect to hear more about heaven and hell and redemption. Heaven, as you know, is fading fast.
Purgatory has just been abolished, and hell, well, hell is with us, as anyone following Australian politics or politics anywhere will realise. But hell does exist, and so does the devil. His name, as you'll hear, is Toby. He's an engineer, attended the same Oxford College as Tony Abbott, and hell is a surprising place.
Ah, hello. It's nice to see you all here. Now, as the more perceptive of you probably realise by now, this is hell. And I am the devil. Good evening. But you can call me Toby, if you like. We try to keep things informal here, as well as infernal. That's just a little joke of mine. I tell it every time. Now, you're all here for eternity. Ooh, which I hardly need tell you is a heck of a long time. So you'll all get to know each other pretty well by the end. But for now, I'm going to have to split you up into groups. Will you stop screaming? Thank you. Now, murderers. Murderers, over here, please. Thank you. Looters and pillagers over here. Thieves, if you could join them. And lawyers, you're in that. Fornicators, if you could step forward. My God, there are a lot of you. Could I split you up into adulterers and the rest? Male adulterers, if you could just form a line in front of that small guillotine in the corner there. The French, are you here? Okay. If you'd just like to come down here with the Germans, that'd be good. I'm sure you'll have plenty to talk about. Okay, atheists. Atheists, over here, please. You must be feeling a right bunch of nitwits. And finally, Christians. Christians, ah, yes, I'm sorry, I'm afraid the Jews were right. That'd be really kind, thank you. Okay, right, well, are there any questions? Yes. No, I'm afraid we don't have any toilets. If you'd read your Bible, you might have seen that it was damnation without relief. So if you didn't go before you came, then I'm afraid you're not going to enjoy yourself very much. But then I believe that's the idea. Okay, well, it's over to you, Adolf. And I'll catch you all later at the barbecue. Bye.
The devil, Toby. He attended Queen's College in Oxford, same college as Tony Abbott, and studied engineering. What else? Don't know whether Toby, or Rowan Atkinson as he's sometimes known, actually interacted with Mr. Abbott, the Toby and Tony show. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Marty Peralta, and next week on RN we shall hear more about that catalyst pheromone party, go to Western Australia to see a new fence protecting wildlife, and worry about the Kepler Space Telescope, which may have died. And don't miss First Bite coming up, with more on smells, or actually not smelling at all. I'm Robin Williams. Avoid hell.